Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Peters, this is the Deeper Waters podcast. I'd like you to start to know that this is a very difficult day for us. The show must go on. Last week we had Mike Lacona on our show, and he talked about his mother being in pain or last stages of cancer. About 2 hours or so ago, she went into the presence of Jesus. So I ask that you be praying for our family right now at this time. But on a better note, though, I am very excited about our show today, still, which must go on. See, in my field, I read a lot of apologetics books, and let me tell you, folks, a lot of them out there, I think they're pretty bad. They're very basic, and they don't really get you into the leading scholarship. There are some books, though, that have been different. So, in my time, it was Case for Christ that lit my fire and got me into the work of the leading scholars by pointing me right in their direction. Another book, though, today that's done that is called Cold Case Christianity. And this book is so good. I read it in just a couple of days, really. It was very, very difficult to put down. Sometimes I had to, but it was very difficult because it reads like a detective account. The author gives you the tools you need to go forward, make the case, learn how to prepare beforehand, and then gives you the facts, and at the same time points you leading scholars, talks about current issues like the God who wasn't there, or Mithras, or things of that sort. And it is just a stellar book. You might have heard of it if you're into apologetics like I am, and its author is the same guy who runs the Please Convince Me podcast. And he is my guest today on Deeper Waters Podcast 1 hour, and that is Mr. J. Warner Wallace. Are you here, Jim?
I am. Thanks so much for having me, Nick, and I'm so sorry to hear the news. That's so bad. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, thanks. It's a really difficult time, but I tell you, I get joy some when I think that right now she is in the presence of Jesus. I honestly can't help but smile a little bit when I realize that, yes, her work is done, she is happy. The grief, it's not for her. It is for us.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And that's just a difficult point. I did track along with you a little bit as this was developing. And yeah, so I know that even though you see it coming and you know that it's about to happen, and it happens to all of us, it's still, like you said, the grief is not really so much that you're grieving her her destiny or her what happens to her. Yeah. Really, we're grieving for ourselves, just the absence of somebody we care about, you know.
Yeah, I do thank you, and let me tell you all that Jim is certainly very genuine in what he said. I count Jim Wallace as a friend of mine here, and the reason I got his book even was because he sent out a copy of his book to anyone who is a head of a Ratio Christi chapter, as I am. So, friends, this is someone who wants the youth of America to be equipped, who wants them to know what's going on, and be ready to make a case, as he puts it, be a Christian case maker. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and actually I feel very lucky because I'm partnered with David C. Cook, which is the publisher of the book, and this is also a not-for-profit publishing house that is involved in global ministry and is simply using publishing as the way to fund its global mission. And so it's a great organization to be part of. And first thing we did, and they asked me, said, who do we need to get this book to? right away, and we'll help you do it. And so here's what we did. We sent a copy of the book to every Ratio Christian director and then some, and we just about 2 weeks ago sent a copy to all the Campus Crusade directors. Mm-hmm. So the idea here is to get this information in the hands of the people who are on the front lines, and of course we're just trying to do that in a way that is available to them. You know, in other words, we don't want to sell this book to the people who need it the most. We want to give it to them so that they can actually turn it around and do work with it. So that's our hope there. We've done that now with Campus Crusade. We have a couple more organizations we're also looking at. So our hope is to kind of extend that even further.
Well, let's start getting a little bit of talking about who you are. I got sent something that I'm going to be replying to in my blog later on next week, but it was saying that these Christians I've ever doing a project, they just came to what they believe, and then they decided they needed to find the reasons for it. And now that's exactly what happened to you, isn't it, Jim?
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, I was one of those skeptics who really needed you to show it to me evidentially. And I was such an evidentialist as a result of my work in law enforcement, working in investigations, yeah, that I just could not. I could not engage something that resembled a blind faith step, and I just couldn't. Just to me, that was a. I've seen people do it. You know, I work suspects all the time whose families can simply not believe that they're capable of doing such things. So they have blindly trusted what the suspect has told them over the years. And, you know, we're constantly trying to say, well, hey, folks, let's take a look at this evidence here and see where it points. And so I couldn't step off as a Christian unless I could first make the case that this was a reliable account, that I could trust what the New Testament said about Jesus. That was huge to me. As a matter of fact, I can tell you that I was far more interested in the reliability of the Gospels. It just came about almost accidentally that I became interested. And I actually came to really a conviction about the reliability of the Gospel accounts before I ever, I mean, it was my conviction about the reliability of the Gospels that caused me to look for the first time seriously at the evidence for God's existence. Because, you know, I always found ways to deny these pieces of evidence, and I was very comfortable denying these pieces of evidence that were out there. But when I got to the point where I really trusted the account about the resurrection, I had to come to grips. You know, I think this is highly underestimated, Nick, that the evidence for the resurrection is an evidence for the existence of God, because there's no other way to explain it. And so for me, this was the first piece of evidence of God's existence, was what I believe to be the reliable account of the resurrection. And so that started me to look at the Accumulo case, and I'm still, you know, look, people put evidences out there for God's existence even, and I am still highly skeptical. This is my nature. Yeah. So I may not agree wholeheartedly with other arguments for God's existence, but I do believe that the evidence that does exist is so highly cumulative that it's impossible to deny. And so I think that you have to be unreasonable in your assessment of the evidence to actually deny the existence of God. The most reasonable inference is that God exists. And then, of course, the question becomes, well, if God exists, which account of God, which description of God is the description that's actually correct? And that's where I think you have to make another case. There's two levels of cases here, one for theism, one for Christianity. But for me, it was the case for Christianity that was most persuasive that got me even interested in the case for theism.
Now, what some of my listeners might not know entirely, though they should from a book title, is you're quite skilled at examining evidence, since you were in the past a cold case homicide detective. For some of my listeners who might not be too sure, can you tell us exactly what it was that you did then and how that's relevant to your examination of Christianity?
Well, I came on the police department 25 years ago, and I'm still working a case that's is unresolved, yet we're still going to trial in October. It's my last case of this agency, and so we still have one more case to go. But what I started doing along the way was working investigations. And as you do that and you're successful, they will quickly move you up the ladder, and I found myself working homicides, and then I got interested in some of the unsolved homicides from the past that other investigators had started but had not been able to complete. And these are, you know, there's no statute of limitations for homicide, so these stay open. If you don't solve the homicide in the first 10 years, 20 years, as long as there's potential to arrest somebody or interview somebody to close the case, these are cases you can still work. And so I began working cases that were in the range of, say, 20 to 25 years old. Now these cases are, you know, well over. I've got one case that's almost 35 years old now that we're about to go to trial on, 34 years old. So these are cases that have not been solved in the past. They weren't my cases originally. They were the cases that belonged to somebody else. What's great about these, though, is that you have to take the time to examine the case evidentially to determine what happened in the past. All you have, usually, are pieces of evidence that are less than you'd hope for. That's why it's still unsolved. You know, you don't have a living eyewitness who can say he saw exactly what happened. That kind of direct evidence is not available to you. If it was, it would have been solved back in the day. So you're looking at putting a case together using other forms of evidence that we might consider to be more forensic, not in the sense that they are forensic like DNA, but we look at cases that are built circumstantially on a series of events, statements, actions, but on the behaviors of the suspect, of other people around the suspect, that all point to the same conclusion. So that it's the only reasonable inference then is points you in one direction or another. And that's what we do with cold cases. And I think there are similar skills that can be applied when looking at the case for Christianity. It's an event in the distant past, no living eyewitnesses, no forensic evidence in terms of DNA or fingerprints, but we can assemble a strong circumstantial case, and that's what my goal was in assembling the evidence for Christianity in cold case Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked how you talked about circumstantial cases, because so many times it seems the skeptics on me talk about both ends of their mouths. One thing they'll say, the gospel is not by eyewitnesses, and then if you can show them up, they'll say, the eyewitness testimony isn't that valuable, and it's not that reliable. And I think your work has shown otherwise. In fact, you give some interesting insights into eyewitness testimony, that eyewitness testimony usually is very contradictory, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not until you've worked cases where you've had to deal with eyewitnesses and you had to deal with defense attorneys who want to make much of apparent contradictions between eyewitnesses. It's not until you've worked these cases that you actually see firsthand how two or three or five witnesses, all of whom offer you something that has a commonality but has great differences in the their own distinctives. When you see this, at first you think to yourself, how in the world could this point to the same conclusion? How in the world could we trust that they're even describing the same event? As a matter of fact, maybe it was giving me confidence, Nick. I've had cases where I had eyewitnesses who originally would testify back 30 years ago. They would be interviewed, and they would offer an account, and the accounts they offered had a number of contradictory or seemingly contradictory elements, things they left out, things they didn't see, things they thought they saw differently, this kind of thing. And so you look at it, and you're reading through the account, and you're thinking to yourself, someone's got to be wrong here. At least initially, you might think that. Well, as you work the case and ultimately make an arrest, and then afterwards interview the arrestee, and he even confesses to everything he did, and you can see then that, hey, these eyewitnesses, they weren't lying. They were all describing something that you know actually occurred, because now the suspect has actually confessed to it. And he's put all the details together for you. And if you work enough of these cases where you actually see them solve and get the confession of the suspect who actually confirms all the different eyewitnesses' accounts, that's when you realize, wow, it is quite possible. It's actually the norm that you have what appear to be conflicting eyewitness statements that are all describing an event that really did happen. We know it now because he's already confessed to it. And so we've removed this idea that, well, maybe there's something wrong with their account. And so this is the job of detectives. We have to come together as a group or as a single investigator, and we puzzle together the eyewitness accounts to see what was it about their either geographic perspective, their emotional perspective, their historical perspective, that it caused them to focus in on one aspect of their of the crime rather than another. And that typically is what explains the differences, is that we all come to the scene with different presuppositions, with different interests, with different experiences that cause us to lock in on one aspect of the crime. And so, of course, when we go back and interview folks, they all offer. Some people, I've had a case where one woman denied there was even the presence of a gun at the crime. When I got somebody who can tell you what kind of gun it was, well, how did she miss that? Was it where she was located in the room? Well, that was part of it, but a lot of it was because she fixed on some other aspect of the crime, and she just visually locked in on that for the entire episode. And so she was able to describe one aspect, but not another. So I guess what I'm saying to you, Nick, is that the idea that there will be some apparently contradictory statements between eyewitnesses that ought to then automatically discredit anything the witness has to say. Of course, this is what defense attorneys try to do in trial, but in the end, we're usually able to overcome that as we show juries how these things piece together and why witnesses might have a certain perspectival difference between each other that would cause them to see things differently.
In fact, in your book on page 74, you got these nice little sidebars in there. It's got this quote from the Section 105 of the Judicial Council of California Criminal Jury Instructions 2006. You probably know what I'm getting ready to read you. Jurors are instructed to be cautious not to automatically disqualify a witness just because some part of his or her statement may disagree with an additional piece of evidence or testimony. Do not automatically reject testimony just because of inconsistencies or conflicts. Consider whether differences are important or not. People sometimes honestly forget things or make mistakes about what they remember. Also, two people may witness the same event, yet see or hear it differently.
Right, and I can tell you that sometimes, you know, there's in some ways some apparent controversy as a Christian to make a statement like this. What I mean is, this idea, well, are you saying that one of the gospel writers is wrong and the other is right? No, that's not actually what I'm saying. I'm saying, though, that if we did have two witnesses in which one you could actually prove they were wrong about some aspect of their testimony, that before I can disqualify that witness, I have to be able to explain why they might be wrong about a particular aspect of it. What I mean to say is this. Every day we go to trial, we make cases with witnesses who are often wrong about particular details, yet are considered reliable by jurors. The difference between inerrant and being reliable.
Yeah.
I've never worked a case where I had a witness who was inerrant. Now, I'm not saying that the Gospels they lack inerrancy. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is if you can make a case with certainty using witnesses that are not inerrant every day in trials, then you can certainly trust the Gospels, okay? Because the standard's a lot lower for witnesses than we require of the Gospels. And that's my whole point here, is that we can look at usual or typical use of witnesses. They are not inerrant. As a matter of fact, I had a case that I used my talks about this. From, let's see, I think it was 1984, it was a murder in which a woman was asked a particular detail about whether or not the door was locked when she went into the business, and she could not recall accurately if it was, but the reason why she couldn't is because she was so desperately concerned when she saw her coworker's car in the parking lot. She knew something was wrong, that car shouldn't be there. She ran in to see what, and of course she found her coworker on the floor. Just the shock of this entire morning, she could not remember specific details that you think, well, how could she not remember that? How could she not remember? Was it locked or unlocked when you came in? Well, these are the kinds of issues that we have to ask ourselves. Is there a good explanation for why you might not even have recorded that detail or remember that detail or whatever? And if we can find a reasonable explanation for that, well, we can still consider the rest of her testimony to be accurate. She testified on maybe 9 other things in that trial which were critical to the trial, and the jurors found her to be reliable on all of those other elements, even though she was wrong about this particular detail. So I think what we do is we say to ourselves, wow, the standard we would use in trial is a worthy and appropriate standard. But don't try to put that on the Gospels, because the Gospels have to be perfect. Because, you know, if they're not perfect, we can't trust a single word. Well, I don't think we would hold that standard to any other real eyewitness. But I'm willing to actually test the Gospels to demonstrate their accuracy regardless. But I know, as a detective, that I could actually live with a lot less than inerrancy and still be comfortable.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm not sure if they practice it over in California, but assuming they did, I mean, on just even this circumstantial evidence that's not inerrant, you could hypothetically send someone to death row, couldn't you?
Well, here's the thing about it. I mean, we have a system in place that has checks and balances. And sometimes you get a kind of hyper-skepticism that says, you know, I don't even think we can trust eyewitnesses. And you know, there's lots of people who get convicted wrongly. Really, I mean, if you look at the number, the percentage of people in our state that are convicted and then that later are overturned either through DNA evidence, you'll see the percentage is incredibly small. I think most of us will live with and can agree if we had a system in place that was 99.6% effective and accurate, would people be okay with that? I think we'd have to, given that, you know, this is it's either that or no system at all. We have a pretty highly effective system, given what we do and the kind of level of criteria we hold. But what's more important is I work these cases all the time, right? And so I have to ask myself as I get ready to file the case with the district attorney, am I convinced that not only am I convinced personally that this is the suspect who did the crime, but do I believe that we can try this case successfully in front of 12 jurors? And that's another issue altogether because, let's face it, we develop a rather sophisticated view of evidence, and we develop a rather sophisticated view of what we see in suspect behaviors as detectives, and most jurors don't have that. I mean, most detectives will listen to a statement from a witness or a suspect and go, oh, come on, he's lying right there. Well, why does the detective say that? Because he's heard so darn many statements from you know, suspects and witnesses. Of course, jurors haven't heard the number of statements we have. They don't see the kind of the deception indicators that we see. We have to help them, have to kind of train them along the way. But I think that's the first level, is the detective convinced? Then is it the kind of case that's so straightforward, basically so simple that we can convince 12 jurors? By the time we get into trial, I mean, we really have to have cases that are solid because we know that there's a high bar there. And we want to be beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I got to say one thing to you, Nick. There was a case we did just us on Dateline in March. It was a case from 1981. It was a nobody missing, which means that the man killed his wife, claimed she ran off. Her body was never recovered, and for 30 years, her family believed his story that his wife had run away, was not actually dead, had not been murdered, but simply ran away. And that was the story he stuck with. And as I got to the trial, I realized I had no confession. I had no body. I had not a single piece of physical evidence, not even a crime scene, because for the first 6 years, no one even worked this case. They assumed she ran off. So with all kinds of unanswered questions and with no physical evidence and simply a series of statements over the years that he made, we were able to convict this guy in 4.5 hours. And wow. Even then, nobody believed us. Nobody believed because it was just a circumstantial case. You don't have any physical evidence. You don't have any direct evidence in the sense of a testimony. That's one thing we can talk about, the difference between direct and indirect evidence. But we didn't have anything like that. And so even the family of the murder victim did not want to believe this was true because they didn't want to believe their daughter was killed. And they certainly didn't want to believe that their beloved son-in-law had killed her. So all of this being the case, we convicted him, and nobody was happy. Nobody believed it was true. At the sentencing hearing, a month after the conviction, he decides to confess to all of it in order to help us recover the body. And it was then that I think most people realized, wow, you know, circumstantial cases are pretty powerful. And the jury got it. They convicted him in 4.5 hours, having seen the entire case. But if there was ever a doubt this circumstantial evidence was pointing to the truth of the matter, he removed that doubt when he confessed. So I think that for me is just another example of the kind of casework in which you can have certainty based on nothing but a powerful cumulative circumstantial case.
We'll talk about the difference between direct and indirect evidence. Right now we need to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll talk about that. I'm Nick Peters, and my guest is J. Warner Wallace of Please Convince Me. We'll be back after this break.
Hi, this is Justin Brierley of the Unbelievable Radio Show and Podcast, recommending another podcast to you. Nick Peters is a deep thinker, a friend of mine, and he has an inspiring faith. So you should listen to him and his excellent guests on the Deeper Waters show. So keep going deeper and keep getting wetter, I guess. Blessings, Nick. Keep up the good work.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Jay Warner Wallace, author of Cold Case Christianity, and who runs the Please Convince Me podcast. If you want to join in, the number is 714-242-5180. Jay's only here for an hour, so we better make the best that we can. Now, you were talking about the difference between direct and indirect evidence. Is that right?
That's correct, and that's typically, I think if there's one skill I hope to provide readers with, and especially the apologetics community, the people who are really interested in the evidences for Christianity, it really is this. It is this understanding of the power of circumstantial evidence, because there's only two categories of evidence, direct and indirect. And when we say direct evidence, we are typically talking about a very limited form of evidence, which is the direct testimony of eyewitnesses who saw what it is we're actually trying, what the thing that's under consideration. So, for example, what we typically do in courtrooms is the judge will instruct here in California, the instruction goes kind of like this. They'll tell jurors, hey, if you have somebody come in from outside, and that person who comes in testifies that it is raining outside, well, on the basis of that one piece of direct testimony, direct evidence, you can determine that it's raining outside, especially if you determine that that witness is reliable. Now, that's just one piece of evidence that would give you the conclusion that it's raining outside. Now, on the other hand, if you saw someone walk in and you see he's wearing a raincoat, and the raincoat's wet, and he's got an umbrella, and he closes the umbrella and shakes off the umbrella and leans it against the wall. You've got several pieces of indirect evidence now, and he's not testifying about anything. You're not talking to him. You're just watching. You see the raincoat. You see the umbrella. You see the water on his raincoat. You got to think to yourself, well, what are the other options here? Is it raining outside? That's a piece of indirect evidence that you can trust to infer that it's raining outside, the same way you could trust the direct evidence of the testimony of the other guy. But here's the important thing about the indirect evidence. You just simply have to ask yourself, it takes a little work. You got to say to yourself, well, what are the other alternatives? Well, maybe it was a sprinkler that got him wet. Well, did he know that sprinkler was going to get him wet beforehand? Is that why he wore a raincoat? I mean, if you really think about it, the only alternatives are not as reasonable as the inference you did come up with, which is that it's raining outside. So that's really the difference between indirect evidence and direct evidence. And in both cases, you come to the same conclusion, but you get there in different ways. And typically, indirect evidence requires a number of pieces that point to the same conclusion. And that's what we're doing with the case for Christianity, is we're looking at it and saying, well, can we trust that this particular passage, whatever it may be, is reliable? Can we trust that this is actually written by the Apostle Paul? Can we, whatever question you may have, we examine it by building a case based on several pieces of evidence that point to some conclusion. And if there's a strong case that points to a different conclusion, we must consider it, because that's how you build indirect cases, is you build them on the strength of a grouping of evidences. And that's what we try to do in the book on a number of different issues. We try to take a look and show you, do I believe that the Gospels date very early? I do. But how do I get there? I get there by building a circumstantial case. I'm looking at several pieces of historical data that are missing from the book of Acts. I'm looking at several pieces of internal data from Paul's letters. I think that when all these things are put together, we've got a strong circumstantial case for the early dating of the Gospels. And that's why I try to give that skill set to readers, so they'll at least have, you know, some idea of how to use evidential rules to come to a conclusion.
And I think what we need to consider also is that at the start of your book, you talk about seeing the evidence beforehand and having an idea of, oh, I know where this evidence leads. Where I think it was a case when it was said, the husband did it, and so everyone starts going off on this case, and then it turns out the husband didn't do it, and your warning there to us is, don't be a know-it-all.
Yeah, it's really coming in without presuppositions that are going to lead you to conclusions that aren't necessarily the best inference from the evidence. And there's times, you know, this particular case, we walked in, it looked like a domestic violence kind of case. We had the position of the woman in the room was such that we thought it was compromising in a way that we really recognized from other domestic violence cases. So we're thinking to ourselves, okay, there's a good chance that it's a boyfriend or her husband. There were some other things in the room, other pieces of evidence that looked like it would be consistent with this as well, at least on first blush. So we made a quick, I didn't make it, but I mean, I was certainly a little wrong with it because I was a new guy, and our senior investigator just said, dude, I've seen a bunch of these. this is going to be a boyfriend or a husband. Let's start looking for her, who she's dating, who she's, if she's married. Let's find this guy. This is going to be a boyfriend or a husband. And it seemed like for the first 5 or 6 hours of that investigation, every single piece of evidence we found was filtered through this idea from the onset that we're looking for a love interest, you know. And it turns out it was a complete stranger to her who was a neighbor who killed her. And we wasted a good week on this idea that came really from our faulty presuppositions. And that's really what I try to warn people. I mean, I had the same kind of faulty presuppositional thinking as an atheist, because I rejected the supernatural out of hand.
Yeah.
So anytime I saw any evidence, I knew it couldn't be God. It couldn't be supernatural. It couldn't. It has to have a natural explanation, because that was my presupposition. That's a danger. If you're going to examine the question, does God exist, you can't begin with the presupposition that nothing supernatural can exist, because this, you've already ruled God out of hand before you begin your investigation. So that's, I think, the problem. And every time I encountered a fork in the road, I had to keep asking myself, is it the evidence that's causing me to want to go this way, or is it really my bias against God's existence, against anything supernatural, that inclines me? But what's the best inference from the evidence here? Let me just allow that to be the thing that guides me, rather than where I want it to go. And that's sometimes a problem for all of us if we're honest with each other.
Yeah, the main idea we encounter in historical studies today is what's called methodical naturalism, where it says that we assume at the start that the past is like the present, which is fair in some ways, but then it says, and we know miracles aren't happening today, which I think Craig Keener would dispute with that, and if anyone's interested, he is going to be my guest on here next month. And then they go from there and say, where, since miracles don't happen, now we're going to go and we're going to examine the case of the New Testament, and where we know Jesus didn't rise because there can't be any miracles. And then usually get asked, where if we accept miracles here, we have to accept them everywhere. No, that's not the case. You accept miracles where there's evidence of miracles. Wouldn't that be a fair way to treat all these cases?
Yeah, I think what happens is we find ourselves, as Bart Ehrman did on the Unbelievable podcast not too long ago when he was debating Mike Lycona, this idea of defining history is the same way that scientists define the scientific process, is that you have to, by definition, they are choosing to, by definition, exclude anything miraculous. So once you encounter a miraculous element in any historical account, well, then you reclassify the account. It can't be history. It's got to be mythology. Because your definition is what's categorizing the account, not because you've got any good evidence to support the most reasonable inference, whatever. And so I think this is really what we have to be careful about. And also this idea that simply because we don't have a personal experience of something does not mean that it can't have occurred. And of course, if this is really important for homicide investigators, because let's say I've investigated 15 kinds of homicides, but there are 50 kinds of homicides, I got to be careful not to always try to fit the next investigation into one of the 15 kinds I've already worked. I've got to be open that I'm going to be surprised. I'm always surprised by the next guy I investigate. He's going to do something that I didn't see coming. And that's important for us to allow ourselves to be surprised, to not try to figure out up front what the rules are in some of these things.
Yeah, I've always been a fan of mysteries. I mean, when I was growing up, I read Hardy Boys and such, and today I like to read Mary Higgins Clark's story when she gets a new one out. And a TV show I used to watch, you know, I got all the seasons on DVD, was Monk, and I know your boss Greg likes Columbo. And whenever you watch these mystery shows, you always have to keep in mind that, you know, this guy seems perfectly clean. He seems like he's got an airtight alibi. That could very likely be the guy who's done the crime, because you're set to realize that I'm supposed to experience something that I would not see coming. That's what the writers want to have happen. And in any cases, that's what anybody who's trying to pull off a murder and not get caught would do. They'll try and do something that you as an investigator would not see coming and would not bother to check into.
Well, what's interesting is, too, is that this idea of being surprised. I mean, I just got done doing a talk at a local church here in Southern California a couple weeks ago. And afterwards, I was approached by a defense attorney who's a Christian who still was processing, in her own mind, she was processing the nature of man. She still, as a defense attorney, had a hard time believing that somebody wouldn't show you some sign of their past criminal involvement. In other words, if you're capable of doing a murder 25 years ago, you're going to show something in the 25 years that follow that's going to, you know, that basically tells, illuminates to people that you're capable of such a thing. And that really has never been my experience. My experience has been over and over again that people, I'm not working serial killers here. I'm working people who did one murder 30 years ago and then spent the last 30 years living like the rest of us, teaching at school, teaching kindergarten, deacons at churches, nurses, people who are in professions that, you know, they're not these guys that you look at and you go, oh, this guy looks like somebody who could have done a murder 30 years ago. As a matter of fact, most of the time, when we interview the neighbors and the friends, they all say the same thing. Oh, I've known this guy for 30 years. There's no way he could ever do such a thing. And so I think it's our worldview as Christians that allows us to understand this thing that we call the enigma of man, how somebody could be capable of doing such a thing, yet at the same time also capable of such nobility or of doing something quite beautiful. And this is, how can this be? I mean, I think a lot of my secular friends and my atheist friends like to kind of categorize people a little bit more cleanly, where they'll say, hey, if you're a killer, you're a killer. And somehow, I guess we're going to see know this. But that has not been my experience practically, and it just so happens that my Christian worldview seems to explain how this could be so, why this could be so. And I talked to this particular defense attorney after the service, I just helped her to realize, you know, she does happen to possess information as a Christian that ought to help her to understand how it is that somebody could so cleverly and so powerfully and so completely disguise and hide their past activity. Do you know what I mean? So I think this is one of the strengths of our worldview, is that it allows us to explain the enigma of man.
Yeah, but what we're getting at with this kind of thinking is that if someone's really going to examine the case for Christianity, they have to be willing to put those presuppositions to the side. And also, this doesn't just go for them. We have to be willing to put our presuppositions aside, because, for instance, if we have a secondary dogma we hold, like if we're a Calvinist or an Arminian or a Preterist or a Dispensationalist or a Younger Creationist or an Older Creationist, if we really want to know what the text is really telling us, though, we have to go to the text and be able to ask it the question and say, you know, my position could be wrong. I want to try my best to let the text speak for itself and tell me what it has to say.
Yeah, I think also it's helpful, and it has been helpful for me, and this is just because, you know, it's hard. I spent so many, it wasn't as though I was, like, raised in this Christian home, and then I had a season of doubt, and now I'm back. It's that I really had no familiarity. I had nobody really who was a strong advocate for Christianity. Instead, my skepticism was allowed to kind of grow up and become, dominate my thinking, that even today, even though I've been a Christian now for 17 years, I am still, I think, many times more an atheist in my first view of any claim. I think I'm still far more likely to say, well, no, that can be explained this way from a naturalistic perspective. That's still the way I would run on almost any kind of claim. And it's now, so again, I think it's been helpful for me, because if nothing else, it helps me to anticipate what folks like me are going to say about that kind of claim. And number two, I think I'm very comfortable. I'm never angry with people who have skepticism or doubts. It seems like in many ways I understand exactly where they're coming from. I'm very comfortable with skepticism and the doubts, because I approach everything first from that perspective. It's part of that also is being in law enforcement. You know, there's this healthy skepticism that keeps you alive, healthy kind of critical view toward humanity, toward the person you're pulling over, toward the person who's trying to give you a story, that although it doesn't really work great in your personal life all the time, it does help you to investigate cases, you know. So I think that that's something that I still have. I still struggle with it a little bit because there's times when it doesn't really serve you very well. But I think my first view is to say, really? Come on. And then let prove it. You know, even any claim that a brother would make about, say, for example, oh, I had this God, like for example, thing that really it's hard for me still as a Christian for the last 17 years is when someone will say, well, I'm sure that God spoke to me about this and told me X, whatever X is. You know, as an atheist for a lot of years, I rejected that kind of thinking outright. And as a Christian who's still skeptical, I still want to run that through a filter that demonstrates to me that's not your imagination, right? I mean, that's just the way I am, and I've got to be really work hard. But here's why I say that, Nick. If we can approach our views, especially if we've been raised in the church, right, and we've accepted these views, like my own kids who have been raised in the church, who maybe haven't looked at these things skeptically as I have, if we can actually approach these without a presupposition to just blindly accept anything that Christianity teaches, but to test everything, we're going to find out that it's still true. We're still going to be Christians because we're stuck with the fact that this is true. And no matter how we push it or massage it or bend it or open it up and examine it, we're going to come back to the same conclusion. It's true. But to get there, through this push and pull of examination, I think makes it, we're just that much more certain. And not only that, we're that much more able to communicate the investigation to others who are just maybe a few steps behind us in the investigation and wondering how to get there. So I think there is some value in having kind of a push and pull faith that doesn't just read and go, okay, but reads and goes, wait a minute, really? How does that make any sense? And then reads some more, and then reads some more, and then reads the other side, then reads this side, and kind of internally debates the issue and comes to a conclusion. Well, guess what? I think we're going to be in a much better place to be able to walk with certainty as Christians and defend what we believe to non-believers.
Okay, we're up on our next break here, and we'll be back after this break. My guest is J. Warner Wallace of Please Convince Me, and I'm Nick Peters, and we're back for our final segment with J. Warner Wallace soon.
This is Mike Licona. Nick Peters is my son-in-law, and I'm excited to announce his new podcast in which Nick will discuss and have guests on topics related to Christian apologetics and dealing with disabilities. Nick has already interviewed apologetic stars such as Greg Kokel and Rob Bowman, and I know of other stars he's in the process of inviting. So be sure to check out Nick's new podcast.
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
And I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast, and we do have one of those apologetic stars with us today. It's J. Warner Wallace of Please Convince Me, and he's here. He's only here for the hour, so this is our final segment with him, unfortunately, but we hope he'll be back again sometime. But, you know, in this final segment, Jim, you've made the case that we need to be making a case especially for the youth, and that's why you sent out all these books to Ratio Christi and now Campus Crusade. So let's spend this last segment talking about why is it so important we make the case for the youth today?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you asked me as an atheist, I would have said, well, you darn Christians, you start that brainwashing early enough. That's your goal, is to brainwash early and often to keep people from actually thinking for themselves. And that's not what I want to do. What I want to do instead is equip young Christians with the ability to think, not to tell them what to think, but to teach them how to think. And that's why when I wrote Cold Case Christianity, yes, there are some facts in there. I mean, you're going to discover, if you haven't thought clearly about the pieces of evidence, you will find them in there. But let's face it, we've all been looking at the same pieces of evidence for 2,000 years. You're not going to find anything new in anyone's apologetics book in terms of the kinds of evidence that are there. But what I hope to do in that book is to give you some new ways to think about evidence in general and then apply those rules to the evidences we have for Christianity. And that's what I want to do with young people. If they give them rules of evidence, so I don't care if they're investigating this claim or if they're investigating, well, what really happened in the life of Abraham Lincoln or what really happened in the founding of our country. We need to have tools in place that will help them to assemble circumstantial evidence to come to a conclusion about the events of the past. And that's what I tried to do in the book, is to give you 10 principles of evidence, a 4-part template for evaluating eyewitnesses, and then apply these things to actually come to a conclusion about the events surrounding Jesus. But you can use the same process to come to the events surrounding any historical event, even if that event is only 4 weeks old. you can use the same set of tools. These are the tools that all detectives use. So I wanted to kind of give those as a template. But the case, I think, is really critical for young people. Nick, and you know it. You've written about it, too. So we're all, I think, doing the same kind of work. It's not folks my age at 52 that are now rising up and forming student unions and student alliances and making a case for atheism. It's really people who are, and leaving Christianity, it's really people who are young, who are in the demographic that is most likely to leave the church. And I don't care who writes at what website and says, well, I'm not quite sure that's true. Really, I mean, I assembled, I think, probably 25 studies in the last 5 years that have demonstrated this repeatedly from any number of different platforms, any number of different religious denominations and even secular organizations. We can't continue to close our eyes to this. It's young people in the range of 15 to 30 who are walking away from Christianity. And why they're walking away, if it's because of their university experience or if it's because of their high school experience or their youth group experience, whatever it may be, we've got to address the issue. And I don't think we get there by continuing to do youth ministry the way we've been doing it. I think we have to start to look at it seriously, to raise the bar, to address the concerns of young people. I've written a lot about this at coldcasechristianity.com because I think it's really important. And so probably the last month, I'll bet just 60% of my blog, my daily blog, has been focused on making the case for young people. But this is something that I am passionate about because I really see it as an important need. I've got four young people of my own in that same age demographic. And I just feel like this is something we have to address if we want to continue to be a force in the culture. If we're willing to submit and lose every bit of influence we have in the culture, but let's take the next 50 years off and do exactly what we've been doing now, because in the next 50 years we'll have no influence on the culture. If we want to continue to be an influence in the culture, we'd better address the people that are right now who will be leaders in the next 50 years. And if we're not willing to do that, we kind of have made the bed we're going to have to lie on. So that's why we are called to get involved in this work.
Yeah, you and I have both written about this a lot. In fact, that's how I found out that you were also sharing my work on your Twitter feed and such, which I was very thrilled about because I write at deeperwaters.wordpress.com, in case my listeners don't know. And this has been a passion for mine because, I mean, students will go off to college, for instance, and then they'll have 25 years of atheism versus their years of Sunday school. And it's not a contest, but it goes on even before then. What I tell parents to do, try and imagine your child up in their room, like a teenager, on the internet, going on YouTube and listening to their favorite Christian song, and then there, what's that on the sidebar? How the Bible is full of contradictions, why God doesn't exist. And heck, even if they don't click one of those, chances are in the comment section of our song, there's a debate going on with atheists. They're not going to avoid the challenges at all. They are right there, and they are traps waiting to capture them immediately.
Right, and I don't suggest that we spend a lot of time, trying to obfuscate the truth or isolate our kids or find ways to give our kids tactics that they can use to ignore what people are saying. No, instead, I think we ought to address each and every one of these claims that they're going to address later anyway. They ought to be addressing those claims with us. And at least get the view from the Christian side. Here's the problem most of the time. It's that if I was to tell, if I was to ask every youth pastor in America, if they were ready tomorrow, pardon me, to start a series with their young people in which they're going to spend the next 8 weeks either responding to the objections of atheists or making an affirmative case for Christianity, I'm afraid most youth pastors would panic. Because that's just the nature of it. I was one of those guys who, even though I had come to faith this way, even though I was critically involved in the evidence, I spent a good year and a half, entertaining my kids as a youth pastor because I thought this was the culture of youth pastordom took over. I copied my peers. I wrote a lot of books in which this kind of thing was being advanced. It wasn't until I watched my kids walk away from Christianity that I said, okay, time out. Now I've got to take these things that I know to be true, and I've got to be able to translate them in such a way that young people can catch the concepts, and that does take work. And there was no curriculum out there that would do it for me. I had to do it myself. And even though I've written a lot about this, and I put all of the stuff that I use with my young people, I put it all online at Please Convince Me. Trust me, that's not going to work for you if you're a youth pastor. You have to start with that and then create something that works for your group. But that's the point, is we all have to be involved. And, boy, it would be a lot easier, honestly. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to just kind of go through your youth ministry the way you've been doing it than it's going to be to change everything to start doing it this way. I get that. And the easier path would be to just continue to do things the way you've been doing it. I understand that temptation. I understand that we're asking you to raise the bar pretty high. But if we don't do it, if we don't become the most aggressive thinkers, if we don't become the most aggressive, and when I say aggressive, I mean passionate, energetic, engaged thinkers in our community, and raise up young people to be the most passionate, engaged, logical, reasonable thinkers in our community, we're doing this all for nothing, because what will happen is they'll get to, like you said, they'll get to the university and someone will persuade them that we're wrong and that mm-hmm. view is correct. And they will be ill-equipped to be able to defend themselves. So I think it's important for us to raise up a nation of young people who are good, solid thinkers, who are aware of the evidence and how the evidence is assembled and can make a case for why Christianity is true.
And, you know, we're talking about youth ministers, and yes, youth ministers need to be equipped. And I'll go even further and say pastors need to be equipped as well. But the case you've made lately is that, well, your youth minister and your pastor should both be doing their work to help equip the child for what's going to come ahead of them in the future. The church is not the first line of defense for a young person, is it?
No, as a matter of fact, it's the pastor, and you're right, pastors need to take up this charge because they need to equip the older folks my age, because the first line of defense is us. It's me as the dad of this student. Because I guarantee you at some point the parent is either going to send some things up and ask the question, or the child's going to come to the parent and say, hey, I got a problem with this. But at some point, one of the very first conversations as a young person walks away from his faith is probably going to be had in the context of a family setting, in which mom or dad wants to know, why aren't you going to youth group anymore? And so the first doubts are typically expressed to parents, if not to friends. I mean, I understand that some people will kind of hide that if they feel like their parents are going to be too judgmental on it. But the point is, parents have to be the ones who can navigate the questions and the doubts. And what typically happens is, you know, I get so many of these at book signs, where people will come and I'm buying your book because I want to give it to my son. You know, he's 19 and he hasn't been going to church and I just wanted him to come back. And my heart's broken for these people because I know that giving the son a book is going to do probably nothing, because he's not probably going to even be willing to read the book. Whatever doubt he had needed to be addressed in its infancy, and it would have been great if somebody at that point, the point of first doubt, could have said, well, wait a minute, here's the problem with the thinking on that position, and showed them how there's a problem with the thinking there. Remember one thing, Nick, most of us as non-believers, and I count myself in this group, we wanted it to be false because we were enjoying the selfish, hedonistic, sinful life we were living, if we're honest with each other. And so because most of us want it to be false so we can enjoy sin, it's going to be easy for us to find ways to accept a lie. Even if the lie isn't that well established, if it isn't that well supported by the evidence, we're still going to be inclined to want to accept it because of our fallen human nature and what we want to do, what we want to do. We want to be our own gods. We want to enjoy the things we shouldn't do. I get all that. So that's why I think we have to be even more equipped to make a case, because the thing we're making a case for ends up being a sacrificial form of life in which we don't put ourselves first. We put something bigger than us first. And it's so counterintuitive for us as humans to do that, that we have to make a really strong case for why this should be so. Because our basic nature is going to be, hey, it's all about me. And I'm asking my young people to accept the view of the world in which it's not all about you. And that's going to take some persuasive evidence, I think, to make that kind of a case. Because it is not, I think, something we would or naturally run to. I think something we would probably naturally run from. So it's going to be important for us to make the case strongly.
And when you talk about the world of temptations, my former roommate, he's quite into apologetics like I am, and we were talking about this recently with this story in California about their having a vote on transgender and that boys and girls could say they're transgendered and use other facilities and such. And we were just thinking about all the chaos that's coming from that, and I was telling him, I said, you know, we have to be able to teach our youth a Christian view on these kinds of matters, because when it comes to temptation, and of course it's largely sexual temptation of them today, they are going to be getting testimonies from their non-Christian peers and people they want to please, and those testimonies are going to have weight. We have to have a good testimony of what Christianity offers on our side to counter that, and why it's important to observe a Christian path when everything in you is wanting to say, no, I want to go this other route.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think there's really an importance of Christian men and Christian women, of course. But Christian men have to step up and get more involved in the church. And what I saw as a guy coming into the church, I was overwhelmed by, if nothing else, the dominant people who are volunteering and are active, they're women. I mean, the church still is, I think, disproportionately dominated by women who are doing the heavy lifting. Aside from lead pastors and those kinds of things, if you notice, you know, it's. I see a lot of, at least where I am, I'm seeing a lot of attendees who are passive, and I think that the idea of being a passive attender anymore is just, if this is true, like C.S. Lewis says, this is the kind of truth that changes everything. This is either, if it's not true, we should walk away from it, but it can't be just moderately true. You know, it's, I think Lewis does a great job of explaining that it's desperately true. It is uniquely true. It ought to motivate and change everything. And there's a recent study that was done on some of the atheist alliances. Some of those students said, hey, they didn't see the kind of passion on the part of Christians that they thought you ought to see if this kind of thing is really true, because if it's true, it changes everything. And it sure didn't seem like Christians felt like that. And I think we all are to blame. I mean, I'm far more likely, and probably you are too, to talk about the last movie we saw with a stranger than we are to talk about Christ with a stranger. So I think this is one of the things we have to really examine in our own heart, is do we treat this, although we say it's not an opinion, do we still treat it like it is an opinion? By the way, we don't share it the way we ought to. Do we recognize it's the cure that is available to everyone who's dying without it? If we thought about that way about it, we'd probably be sharing it a little bit differently. And that's the thing I think that's important for why we as casemakers do this job. We want people to feel that way about this truth claim, and then to work hard knowing what it is they believe so they can make a case. So,
yeah, we've got about 3 minutes left in this segment, and so I want to let my listeners know before we have to let you go here, since you said you'd only give us an hour, that there are few podcasts that in my busy schedule I listen to regularly. Of course, I definitely tell all of you listen to this podcast regularly as well, but the other two is I listen to Unbelievable when that comes on, and I listen to Please Convince Me. So, Jim, your podcast is right up there on one of the ones that's on the must listen to. I'm downloading on Friday, and I was like, where's the latest one?
Oh, it's so fun. I'm so glad to hear you say that, and I really have enjoyed doing it. And that's today, as a matter of fact, that's the next thing I've got to – it's funny how you get really pretty busy, don't you, as far as how you make a case. So as soon as I get off the phone with you, I'm on the phone with somebody else, and I can tell you that any time I'm asked to come and make a case on a podcast like yours, if I'm available, I'll come and do it. And the reason why I think it's important for us to make this case, and you're doing exactly, Nick, what we talk about all the time on the Please Convince Me podcast. Get out there, find a way to be the $1 apologist. That's all I've ever considered myself to be. But instead of having a $1 million apologist, we want a $1 million apologist. All of us, if we can do it, Nick, others can do it. I don't know where you are right now, but I'm doing it from my extra bedroom in my house, okay? So we can quickly buy the equipment. Yeah, do it sufficiently so we can make a case on the air in a podcast format. And before you know it, you'll have thousands of people who are listening to your podcast every month, and suddenly you're having an impact from your bedroom. So, I mean, think about this. If you're listening to this podcast and listening to Nick, take his example and get out there and be a good $1 apologist.
Thank you, Jim. And, yeah, we live in my grandmother's old house. The extra bedroom was converted into my office, so it's lined with all my bookshelves and such, and I do this just from home. I don't have any money. I've got just a little headset here, and I'm doing this regularly and getting guests on here just by emailing them and saying, hey, will you be on my show? Will you be on my show? That's how I'm getting these guests on here. Now, Jim, we've only got a minute left. Your book, Cold Case Christianity, it's available on Kindle. It's available on Amazon. But you've also said that, you know, if you're available. Okay, let's suppose you're available. How do people get in touch with you? How do they find out more about you? Things like that.
Yes, absolutely. I'm part of Stand to Reason at str.org. I work there with Greg. I'm a volunteer at that organization with Greg Kokel, Brett Kunkel, and Alan Schliemann, and I've been just delighted to be part of that team. And I blog daily now at coldcasechristianity.com. I double post at Stand to Reason sometimes, or at Please Convince Me if there's a need. But I blog every day at Cold Case Christianity, just trying to give people some tools on a daily basis. You can subscribe to my daily blog just so you can kind of follow along with me and see what the case is. If I think of it, if it comes up in a discussion like with you, Nick, I will go right to that blog and start blogging on it. And I'm hoping to give tools on a daily basis that will help people make a case for the Christian worldview.
I'd like to thank Jay Warner Wallace for being my guest here for this hour. When we come back, I plan on talking about the DOMA case. I'm sure a lot of you are wondering about that, give you my thoughts on, but Jim, you go off, and I suppose it'd be appropriate to do what your boss would say to do and give him heaven wherever you go.
That's right. Thanks so much, Nick, for having me on. I appreciate you. You know, I'm a big supporter. I love you, and I think you're doing a great job there. Just keep it up.
Okay. Hope we have you on here again sometime.
For sure. I'll be happy to come back.
Thank you. All right. And really, my great thanks, Jim, and everything we say here is genuine. Jim's just a great guy, and I really appreciate him. He's gone out of his way a lot of times to help us out, and we're definitely appreciative of it. But right now, it's time to take a little break and come back. We are going to be talking about DOMA some, so I expect to have an interesting chat here.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
Check out cyiworldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
And I am Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. Again, we thank my guest, Jay Warner Wallace, for being here the first hour. Second hour, you got just me. So I hope that doesn't bore you too much. But my number to call in if you want to chat with me, if you disagree, if you want to ask a question, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be on this topic that I'm getting ready to talk about. If you've just got some projects query that's eating away at you, give me a call, 714-242-5180. And I also like to remind everyone what I said earlier today, that be in prayer for our family. We just found out a few hours ago that my wife's grandmother has gone into the presence of Jesus. She'd been battling cancer for a while, and her battle's done, and we grieve, but as the text says, we mourn, but not like those who have no hope. In fact, I sent Mike a message that at times like this, aren't you thankful for the resurrection? And if you recognize the case for Christ, you realize that's the exact same question I was asked to Gary Habermas, and his reply is, yes, I am very thankful for the resurrection of this time. You know, if it wasn't for that, I really don't know how I'd be approaching these things. I don't know how I could tell you that I can still have joy in the midst of this, because I know, you know what, she's in the presence of Jesus. She's so much better off. And right now, in our world, a lot of Christians are really hurting because of events that have happened recently. That's talking about the Defense of Marriage Act. Now, I want to say something right at the start. I love marriage. I think marriage is wonderful. It's great. I mean, Allie's going to be going up to Baltimore for the next couple of days. She's flying up tomorrow to attend the funeral. I can't come, and you know, it's going to be pretty hard for me here alone. She and her mother went somewhere once here, and they were just here in the city. They were staying at a hotel because they needed to be somewhere downtown in the morning together immediately, so they didn't want to risk it. And that night, I had a reasonable faith meeting, and honestly, I didn't want to come home that evening because it was so empty when I got here. I couldn't believe how lonely I was fearing. I mean, I'd lived with a roommate for a while, and when he went away, he'd go back home, and it'd be like, well, okay, this is different, but yeah, I can handle this. But when I was gone, it's like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with myself here? And even if we're not always doing everything together, there's still an emptiness. It's like, she's supposed to be here. But I know she's got to be there, and there are going to be times in the future in my ministry, I'm going to have to be out traveling, and she's going to be here. And we have to get used to this. And I'm saying, I love marriage. At the same time, I want to affirm something. I've got several friends who listen to this show who are not married. Some of them want to get married. Some of them don't really want to. That's awesome. Okay? Not everyone is called to be married. I mean, one of my dearest friends, she's a widow, and for the longest time I kept trying to say, well, have you considered so-and-so? Have you considered so-and-so? And then finally she wrote me something about why she's not really looking for marriage. Just, you know, if that changes, yeah, I'm open, but until then, that's just the way it is. I'm like, okay, I'm going to respect that. I haven't said anything since then. But wonderful lady, great friend, great trust I've got there. And, you know, we can have this great danger that we'll look at people in our society that if they're not married, there's something wrong with them, they're incomplete, singers are looked down on. I don't want any of that. Okay? If someone willingly chooses a single life, they want to be single, we should honor that. We should celebrate that. If someone wants the married life, if they're single now, we should try and help them prepare for that. If they're married, of course, we want them to strengthen their marriage, sustain their marriage, and we want the church to celebrate marriage. But if you're single or married, either one, DOMA is relevant to you. Because DOMA is about the future of our country. Now, I'm not going to be talking about this from the real scientific perspective, but just from the moral perspective. See, a lot of people out there are looking at this and saying, well, we can't allow this because the Bible condemns homosexual practice. And yes, it does. But I think that approach is a mistake, honestly. See, whenever we enter a debate and someone comes with evidence from another field, and we come with evidence just from the Bible. Sorry, friends, but in the eyes of the public, the Bible is going to lose every time. Now, I think the biblical case is a winner, but at the same time, I think it's less important that the Bible says something, and more important to know, why does the Bible say it? And since I think it's quite clear the Bible condemns homosexual practice. And if you want the word on that, I am going to be having Robert Gagnon on here August 3rd. He's going to be my guest. He wrote the book, The Bible and Homosexual Practice. He's going to be making the case that, yes, the Bible does unequivocally condemn this. But we also need to know, why does the Bible condemn this? And that, I think, is part of natural law thinking. That's part of sexuality. And we need to have a Christian view of sexuality. We need to know what's going on. Our culture usually wants to say it's just sex. Well, it's not just sex. Okay? I'm a guy. I'm going to tell you, it's something awesome, it's something great, it's something wonderful, okay? I am no way going to get up here and say sex is a bad thing. Or as a joke usually goes, someone gets told that I was taught two things about sex when I was growing up. Number one, it's dirty. Number two, I should save it for someone I love. Part of this is we are going to have to change the message we are giving our youth about sex. We are telling them things to do and things not to do. We have good intentions. We have bad reasons behind it. I was at a church one time when I was in my mid-20s or so, and there was a talk going on about the silver ring thing, okay? Abstinence, all for that and such. All these young people coming up. By the way, Lauren Winner, the author of Real Sex and Naked Truth about Chastity, has said that these programs like True Love Waits and such, they usually only make abstinence last about 18 months longer. We need more. anyway, this pastor gets up and he gives a message about it. And he tells these young people, he says, look, if you have sex before you're married, you're going to be doing it for selfish reasons. Okay, I can go with that. He says, now think about this, though. You could get pregnant. You could get an STD. Think about the shame that you would face on your way out. Think about how embarrassed you'd be. Think about all the guilt that you have. Now, I'm listening to this, and I'm going to raise my hand and just say, excuse me, pastor, those sound like pretty selfish reasons to me also. You know what? I think they are. There isn't this message of, you shouldn't do it because it's wrong, and here's why it's wrong. And as Lauren Winter said, not everyone's going to feel guilt. There are some young people who have sex outside of marriage, have premarital sex, and they don't feel any guilt whatsoever. And you know what they start thinking? They start thinking, geez, the church was wrong about that. I wonder what else they're wrong about. And like I was discussing with Jim, our young people are getting testimonies about this from their peers. If you're a virgin in school, you're quite likely to be mocked. Interestingly, the secularists, I know of where, very quickly mock a guy who hasn't slept with a girl as being gay or homosexual. Christians, we should never have that kind of mocking. If we do that, we're only hurting the people we should be out there trying to reach. Being homosexual or being gay, I prefer to use the term homosexual, is not a reason to mock someone. And if it becomes an insult, it gets a problem. Strangely enough, a tolerance police aren't out there as much for that one. But these kids need a reason. They need to know, if I'm waiting, what am I waiting for? And why am I waiting? So honestly, when this pastor was speaking of a service I was at, I was getting bored. If you give a message at a church, and there's a guy in there who's in college, and he's hearing it, and it's a message about sex, and he's getting bored, you are doing something wrong. You are presenting the message in a wrong way. Because we need to highlight the positives and the negatives for our young people both. We need to say, hey, this is something awesome. This is something incredible. This is something wonderful. It's going to be so awesome when you get to have this. But you have to wait. And here's why. And there are a number of things we can say. The thing is that we talk about how much someone is worth. When you're talking about this kind of topic, what you're essentially asking is, what's my price? There's a story about a man who was on a plane, and he found himself sitting next to an attractive woman, and he started talking with her, and he said, I am incredibly, incredibly wealthy, and I want you to know, I find you incredibly attractive. Would you be willing to give me a night of passion for $1 million? And, well, she's a bit hesitant at first, but after a while she says, you know what, I think I'll do this. So we start arranging things. And then after a while he says, you know, I have to be honest with you. I was lying a while ago. I'm not wealthy. Would you be willing to do this for $10? And she looks at him and says, what kind of woman do you think I am? And he responds by saying, I believe we've already determined that. We're just now haggling over the price. So, for you women out there, I have to ask you, how much are you worth? Are you worth dinner? Are you worth a movie? Is that all it takes? Does a guy have to date you for a week? Does he have to date you for a month? Does he have to date you for a year? Do you have to be engaged? Or do you wait till marriage? How much are you worth? Because, you know, these guys out there, many of them will say anything they can just to get what they want. Because when it comes to men like myself, usually all we want is just the action itself. Okay? We're just that way. Woman usually wants something else in return. It doesn't mean she doesn't enjoy the action itself, but usually she's wanting emotional closeness, love, security, protection, anything like that. And you have to ask yourself, is this guy able to give it? Is this guy in it for the long haul with me? Or is he just using me? You know, there's a good way to find this out, women. See if he'll marry you. You know, if he walks down that aisle with you, you can be pretty sure he's in it for the long haul. That he wants to give himself to you entirely. And he's not going to betray you, abandon you, anything like that sort. And if you wait until then, you are telling guys that is how much you are worth. You have to be paying the price. Now, some of you girls out there that are willing to do this, God bless you. And I want you to realize, all these other women out here that are setting the standards lower, they are your enemy. They are the ones that are lowering the price for everyone else. They are lowering the reputation of women. They are making guys, they are giving guys something easier without really earning it, without really recognizing it. Every woman out there, you need to realize you are a treasure in yourself. And don't let any guy use you. Because once you start, it's very hard to stop going down that path. Because anytime you have this intimate relationship with someone, you become connected to that person in some way. Your bonding is right there. And the more you bond with more people, the harder it will be to keep a consistent bond. And there have been studies done that have shown this very thing. So this is what we're going to have to return to. We're going to approach DOMA right. We're going to have to give a Christian view of sexuality. I'm telling you, youth pastors, pastors, parents, when your son or daughter are with their date and they're on a couch together, it is going to take more than a few verses from Paul to keep them from crossing that line. Look, I'm a Christian guy. I'm just wholeheartedly in this. I suffer intense guilt if I think I do anything whatsoever wrong. And my wife will often say, "You're still worried about that? Are you ridiculous with that?" But yeah, I am. I'm that guilty with that kind of thing. You know what? When we were dating, I was very, very tempted at times. And, you know, I'll tell you, if you're not tempted, I think there's cause for concern. That temptation's going to come. And we need to have the reason set up in advance. And with that, we need to have the positives and the negatives both. And the negatives can't just be things like disease and pregnancy. Because, you know, people just think, you know, you use proper protection, you've got that taken care of. Now, I know it doesn't always work, but if they think that, that's going to not be able to stop them. And in fact, even if you convince them otherwise, most young people have this idea that they're invincible, and that, well, that's going to happen to someone else, but it's not going to happen to me. I'm going to go ahead and do it, and heck, many of us, we know that when we're in those arms, that if our hormones start acting up, it's very hard to really think about anything else, and it's very hard to be rational and say, I really should be being safe right now. Now, it's not going to happen. So the first thing I'd say with DOMA is we need to have a Christian view of sex, because our young people do not have this view of sex. and that's really affecting their judgment. Well, there was more I'd like to say on this. We'll be back after this break in order to discuss that.
Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grock as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told, every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at CYIWorldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I'd like to remind you all, yes, this is listener-supported. And we definitely need your support. And especially if you've been liking the Deeper Waters podcast, if you've been liking the work that I've been doing here, this stuff needs funding. Okay? I do this stuff sincerely out of a desire to spread the gospel, but I do need your support. I want to know you are standing with me prayerfully and, if possible, financially. And we're getting it set that one of the best ways you're going to be able to donate to us is to donate to the Ratio Christi Issues and Answers chapter, our rapid response team that I'll be running, doing pretty much what I do here, answering the questions as soon as I can. So if you got some extra money set aside and you're trying to say, I wonder what ministries I can support, please consider Deeper Waters. Now, my number here, if you want to call and talk to me, is 714-242-5180. Now, I said I was going to be talking about DOMA, and so some of you are wondering, why are you talking about youth and sex if you're supposed to be talking about homosexuality? Well, my friend Jerry Walls from HBU has written an article where he asked about why our young people are not always engaged in this fight. Now, I want you to know there are several young people who are engaged in a fight for marriage. God bless them, just like there are several who are engaged in the fight for life against abortion. But some of you saw on Facebook these equals signs showing up everywhere, even from Christians. You wonder, why is it showing up? Well, Jerry Walls' article gives a good answer. Part of it is because they've already accepted the world's message on sexuality. They've told themselves fornication is no big deal. Premarital sex is no big deal. And if they're going to accept that testimony, well, what reason do they have for disregarding the testimony of Scripture and the Church on homosexuality? Really, they don't have any left. What they would most likely think is you're either expressing a bigoted religious viewpoint or that you are expressing a personal taste. And that's all there is to it. And what we have to say is, no, we are not. We're not telling you how we feel about homosexuality. I mean, a homosexual could get up and make the exact same case. You could say he's being a hypocrite, but he could make the exact same case. Or he could be someone who's struggling and says, you know, I really want to go this way, but I know I shouldn't, and here's why. This case is not about how we feel. It's not about our perceptions of what we think homosexuality is. It's about the objective case that's out there. It's asking the question, what is it? In this it, what we want to know about is marriage. What is marriage? We've been told, for instance, by people that two persons in a loving relationship equals marriage. Well, you know, if that's the case, I sometimes wonder if my former roommate and I were married. Because then we had brotherly love for each other, no doubt. I mean, he's my best friend. Among guys, still is my best friend today. Does that mean that two roommates that come together and decide they're going to live in a house or apartment together, even though there's definitely no sexual relationship of any kind whatsoever, they'd be considered married? Or what? And how far does this go? If a mother comes to live with her son, suppose it's an elderly mother, her husband's passed away, she's a widow, and her son doesn't have a wife, but he's got extra money, he's got an extra room, and he says, Mom, you come live with me, I'll take care of you. So they live together. They love each other, no doubt. Are they married? Does this mean people that cohabit are automatically married? If so, do they need to go down to a courthouse at all, even, and get a license? What is marriage? This is the big question, and this is a question that's not being asked. Unfortunately, you got people like how Bill O'Reilly has even gone on Fox and said, you know, on the other side, you got these cases being made, and on our side, just got people thumping the Bible. Not at all. Not at all. We have real cases, real evidence, real reason. And this is why I say we have to get beyond just thumping the Bible. We have to speak the language that the people we're going to witness to are speaking. For instance, my wife would love to be a missionary to Japan someday. Go to Japan and share Christianity over there. To me, what good would it do if she goes over to Japan and the only language she can speak is English? She is not going to be able to reach the Japanese people the way she wants to. Yeah, several people in Japan do speak some English, of course. Some could speak it pretty well. But to reach most people, she'd need to speak Japanese, the common language there. If you're going to go and speak to the culture, you need to speak the language that they speak. Say, well, I accept the Bible as an authority. Good for you. Why should they? And if you go out of the Bible, you know what's going to end up happening? You're going to end up debating over and over instead of questions like, what's the relationship of the law today? Or why is it that you're allowed for tattoos? Or do you eat shellfish? You know those are called an abomination. You can bypass all of that entirely. Now, of course, I think it's good to have answers for questions like that. And if someone does bring up objections like shellfish or something of that sort, I can assure you they are doing nothing more than displaying their ignorance. But the sad thing is most of us in the church have ignorance on how to answer those kinds of objections. So that's why I say go straight to a case from natural law. What is marriage? Like we've been told, is usually where if you have two consenting adults. Okay, you can ask that any time about those questions. Why two? Why limit it to two? I tell you, polygamists were getting very excited about the DOMA ruling, and I don't blame them, because that's just a natural stepping stone. If you're going to allow this redefinition of marriage, why not the other one? Why do they have to be consenting? Who says it has to be consent? Because if there's no objective thing called marriage that we're describing, that we're just making it up as we go along, it doesn't have to be consenting. It can be whoever you want then. You can declare yourself married to someone for all we know, and they don't have any choice but to accept it. Why? Why does it have to be loving? In fact, when two people go to the courthouse or to the state and they want to get a license to get married, they are not asked, do you two love each other? Now, they might be asked that by some employee who's, you know, just wanted to celebrate with them and such, but it's not an official requirement of a state. When Allie and I went and got our marriage license, we were not asked, do you two love each other? And if we'd said no, even they wouldn't have said, well, we can't give you a marriage license, then you have to love each other. No, they would have given us a marriage license anyway. All they wanted to look at and see was, okay, here's a man, he's of age, he's legal, he's not related to her, He's consenting. Here's a woman. She's of age. She's legal, not related. Consenting. Let them get married. And that's it. So we can ask, why adults? Why can't we let 5 or 6 year olds get married? Why not? Why can't we let teenagers get married? And by teenagers, I mean maybe 14 or 15, because technically my wife was 19 when I married her. Why not? What's going to stop us? These are questions we have to ask. And if you study this kind of thing, what you have to realize that people often overlook is unintended consequences of what they're going to be doing. They might think they have good intentions. I don't doubt that many people in this battle who are arguing to redefine marriage, I don't doubt that they have very good intentions. They really sincerely think they're doing the right thing, not questioning that for a lot of them for a second. But I say to that, so what? Everyone really thinks they're doing the right thing. Everyone wants to pursue the good. Question is, are you going to give it to us? Who benefits? How is it that you think society would benefit if we redefine marriage? Because we've been down a similar road before. We were told when no-fault divorce was being discussed, we were told that it would help children. Children would not suffer from it. If we can get mom and dad to be happy, well, we can rest assured that children would be happy. That isn't so. Children have not been made happier because of divorce. Anything has added more problems to them. They've been less trusting in their future marriages or just their future sexual relationships whatsoever. And when we've undone this genie from a bottle, it's been very difficult to put back in, if it's going to be at all possible. And I'll tell you something about this DOMA case. One part that really upsets me about it is that the homosexual population, they're about 2 to 3% or so, I'd say even 5 at the most, of a population, and they are changing our culture this much. We Christians have a far greater percentage of a culture and population. We are far more numerous. And we make the claim that we have divine truth on our side. What are we doing? You know, DOMA would not have gone away if we had not dropped the ball. If we had been doing what we were supposed to be doing all this time, we would not be in this mess. When I talk to Christians, I say, look, if you want to know what's going wrong, we have met the enemy. It is us. Now, I'm not denying there's an enemy out there. There definitely is. But the thing is that I expect people who aren't Christians to act a certain way. It's a tragedy when Christians don't act like Christians. And this is what Jim was on here a while ago just saying, that we need to be making the case that mom and dad are the first defense. And if we're not equipped to make this case, we are going to lose this battle. And already, we've got things stacked against us. We have allowed the culture to believe lies that we have done nothing about, because we have been dwelling in a soundbite culture where if something sounds good, it's true. Where you can throw out these pithy little sayings that have no substance behind them, but they just seem, oh, so powerful. And they persuade a whole culture. We can do much better than this. If every Christian got up and actually started doing something instead of being passive and sitting on a pew and expecting the church to serve them. If we get out and we realize we are supposed to serve Christ, he is not supposed to serve us, and start living accordingly, we could save our country. We could change this whole thing. We could turn it around. If you're sitting here and you're listening to this and you're complaining about the way the world is, which I don't blame you, you should be, and you're not doing anything, you know, as far as I'm concerned right now, you're part of the problem because you're holding us back. We need you to be doing something. I don't care what it is. I don't care how small it is. Do something. Be volunteering at your church to teach them a Christian view on these matters. Be willing to debate it even on your Facebook. Share those articles that you read that show why Christian marriage is so important. Write your congressmen. Write your senators. Do whatever you can. Make your voice known. You know what the great power of a homosexual lobby has? They've learned that if you go up there and you scream enough and you make enough noise about the topic, people start paying attention to you. You know, I'm not saying we use the exact same methodology, but we should be out there making some noise. Because we have something to make noise about. You know, chances are you're not going to go to Congress tomorrow and write new legislation. But you can start with how you're going to be witnessing to your neighbor. How you're going to be witnessing on the internet. What you're going to be doing at your church. Where is your money going to be going to, for instance? Is it going to be going to programs like this? Or are you going to send it to people like Joel Osteen and others who are just wanting to rip you off, as far as I'm concerned? Are you going to send it to ministries that will make a difference? Or just send it to people that will support you? Because, Vince, we only get one shot at it. We can't recover any lost time. This isn't a video game where we can push a reset button and go back to an earlier time in America and try again. This is what we're talking about is our children. Our young people are at stake. What kind of country are we going to have them grow up in? Are they going to grow up in a country where any kind of sexual immorality will be allowed? Where there will be no more standards? Where the terms mother and father will be essentially meaningless? Where marriage would be but a memory? Or are they going to grow up in a culture where they're going to learn that there is such a thing as real love in marriage? There is such a thing as right. There is such a thing as wrong. There is such a thing as truth. Are they going to grow up in a culture where they practice real sexual fidelity? Where men grow up learning that they are to honor women. They are to respect women. They are not to use women as objects. And where women grow up learning that they are to respect men. They are to treat men like men. And they are not to let themselves be used as objects, nor are they to let themselves use men as objects, which, yes, women can do. They can just as easily give men what they want to get something they want in return and let that be the driving force there. We can all be very, very good at using each other. Question is that going to be our future? I was listening to Robert Gagnon talk about this. He said, we need to be having a sermon on sexuality in the church every month. I agree with him. We definitely do. Because our culture is not getting a message. This means we have to send off more of the little children who aren't teenagers yet to special classes in the church so the adults can get some real hard talk and the teenagers can get a bit of it as well in the service. Well, by golly, we do that. Because our children are worth it. Our future is worth it. I'm getting tired of going to every Independence Day and wondering, I wonder how many more we have left here. How long are we going to be a free culture? So tell you, the persecution, it's coming. it is going to be on top of us before we know it, if we don't stand up now. Don't wait till tomorrow. Stand up now. We'll be back for our final segment after this. If you want to join me, my number is 714-242-5180.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grock as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told, every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. My call-in number is 714-242-5180. So I could lay out some basic points about why this matters here, as well, what kind of case we can make, to use the language of Jay Warner-Wallace again. Our government knows darn well that men and women don't really need much excuse to come together. We give benefits to couples when they get married, but most couples really don't get married with those benefits. Allie and I did not get married because we were thinking, gosh, it'd be so nice to have those tax benefits that come from getting married. No, we had other reasons for getting married. And most people have realized when men and women come together, eventually you can expect that some babies will generally come from some of those marriages. There seems to be a corollary between those two. There's a connection there. Not every couple has babies. Not every couple will have babies. But that's the idea that comes, that usually you can expect there will be children. And we don't need much incentive to do this. Believe it or not, even if you don't plan on having kids, men and women don't need much incentive to have sex. Okay? Especially not we men. Usually, that's enough reason in itself. The state knows this. They don't need to reward us. And they also know they would not exist if it wasn't the case that men and women were getting married and having kids. You go to any country out there, if that country stops having kids altogether, it's going to die out within a generation or two. It's going to be gone. Every country needs to have its population being renewed regularly. In this case, then, the family is the basis for the state. The state is not the basis for a family. The state protects the family, but it's not the basis for a family. The family can survive on its own. So what happens if you redefine marriage? If you redefine marriage, what it's doing is that the state then has to create something that has not existed before. It has to create a new kind of union, and then in turn, it has to defend that union. And when it has to defend that union, that means it has to step in and face challenges to that union. What does that mean for us? It means less freedom. And we've already seen this happening. A photographer who was asked to photograph a lesbian ceremony, a wedding ceremony, said no, because she was a Christian and that went against her beliefs. We have a couple found another photographer who was wearing, and the photographer did it. Then this couple went back and sued the Christian photographer because she did not celebrate their union. Charities in Massachusetts were asked, Catholic charities were asked, to start giving children to same-sex couples or else they would have to close their doors. We have a state didn't have to do it. The charities closed their doors anyway. A couple in the UK who had adopted numerous children, an elderly couple, they were turned down to have another child adopted. Why? Because they were Christians and they took a stance on homosexuality. The message is already getting out there. If you live in Canada, in some places, they have a registry of homophobic acts condemning you if you practice heterosexism, which is the view that heterosexuality is normal. And as my friend Jennifer Roback Morse at the Roof Institute says, newsflash, heterosexuality is normal. What it means is that the government there has been given power to stamp out a true statement. And the more this goes on, the more the state is going to have power. Some of you are saying, well, maybe the government should get out of it altogether. That won't work, though, because the government does have a vested interest in what goes on, and we can't just let anyone come together and form a union and have to defend it. The government sets laws and standards. It's their purpose to defend the family, not attack it. Now, part of this also is comes to when we get to the question of children, there is something called the presumption of paternity. Let's suppose in the future Allie and I decide to have a kid. And she gets pregnant, and lo and behold, I'm an accomplished apologist, and I go out there, and around the time the baby's due, I'm having to speak at a conference. Where I get a call, well, your baby's here. Sorry, whoever's conference I'm speaking at, I'm heading back home. So I head back home, and I go into this delivery room, there's Allie, and this doctor comes up to me and says, and who are you? And I say, I'm her husband. And they say, well, congratulations, Dad. What just happened there? Here's what happened. I came in. They find out I'm the husband. They assume I'm the reason she's pregnant. And that's darn rightfully so, of course. And so they say, because you are the husband, you are the father. Okay? Because how do we know who the mother of a child is? Well, usually that's pretty darn obvious for us, because the woman who's lying there screaming, crying out, and yelling, why did you do this to me, is most likely the mother. Just a guess, but the woman giving birth is quite likely the mother. Identifying the father can be the hard part. But if you're the husband of a woman, you are the presumed father of any children that she bears. Does this work the other way? If instead a woman's in a lesbian relationship and she gives birth and in comes a woman she's in a relationship with, is the other woman responsible for the pregnancy? No. She could have arranged an artificial insemination. She could have done all the calls, anything like that. But biologically, she is not in any way the other parent of that child. Nor could she ever be biologically. And the problem that we're finding then is that the presumption of paternity does not work as a presumption of parentage. And what we have then are cases where a child is said to have three parents, sometimes even more than three parents. Well, even in, I think it's British Columbia, you can have a birth certificate that says mother, and the next slot says father or co-parent. You see the message that's being given here? Men, be prepared for this. What message is being told is you are replaceable. You as a father are replaceable. Anything you can do, a woman can do. Anything a woman can do, it's supposed to be the other way, you can do. Gender doesn't really matter. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Men and women are very, very different parents. I mean, if you're like me growing up, think about this kind of situation. If you wanted to do something that was somewhat risky, somewhat dangerous, which parent generally would you go to? It would be Dad, every single time. Mom would want to protect you. You'd go to Dad. Now you're outside, you fall, you skin your knee. Which parent are you going to go to? Generally, it's going to be Mom. No one does better at that usually than Mom does. Mom's a big, sympathetic one. And mothers make a difference with these things they do with their kids. They don't even realize it. When you're playing peekaboo with your child, you are bonding with your child. When you're singing songs to them, doing all these little things most sociologists might not even notice, because, frankly, a lot of mothers aren't going to tell them because they assume that it's already known that's what they're doing. You are forming a relationship with your child. You are bonding an attachment with them. A lot of you might know about attachment disorder, but it happens when children are put in daycare facilities and such, and they're not really bonded with other adults. They don't know how to form attachments. This is a serious situation. The point that we get at Finn is children are best raised by their biological mother and father. Now, this isn't to say step-parents can't raise children. Of course they can. It's not to say adoption should not be used. Adopted parents can raise their children. Great. With adoption, though, we have to remember, adoption is to find parents for children. It's not to find children for parents. Adoption exists because children need parents. It does not exist because parents need children. And when we go out and we have all these step-parents that come in, it can often give trouble to a child, because the step-parent usually is not as bonded to the child as the parent is. Some of you out there, I know this is not the case, okay? And if this isn't the case for you, I'm not concerned about you right now, okay? Some of you have stepchildren, and you are wonderful step-parents. You love that child as if they were entirely your own biologically. God bless you. You're wonderful. Keep it up. But you know there are cases out there that aren't, such as when the mother has a revolving door of boyfriends coming in, and the kids have to start thinking, do I call this one daddy or not? And each man can then in turn view the children as if they are a threat to his attention and love from the mother. That if he wants that woman's attention, those kids are often getting in the way. And those kids can become an enemy. And the kids can learn how to play off of each relationship. Kids are very, very good at learning how to use their parents' relationship to their advantage. And when children then also, they don't have both of these parents, they do suffer for it. This isn't to say that every child without a parent is a hopeless case. If you're a child and you don't have a mother, you're not a hopeless case. Well, you do have a mother, but of course what I mean is you don't live with him. You're not a hopeless case. You don't live with your father. You're not a hopeless case. But you've got something set against you right at the start, whether it be through a fault of your parent or not. And some of you might have lost a dad, for instance, who served in the military, and he died in combat. And, you know, that's not the fault of your mom or anything like that, but you know you suffer for it. You know that there's a part of you that wishes your dad was there. And a lot of these kids who don't have a dad, where do they wind up? Well, a lot of young men, especially, they wind up in juvie. They're out there committing crimes. These women who don't have a father, where do they wind up? They wind up pregnant. They wind up in sexual relationships a lot of times, and it's because they're trying to get that same kind of affirmation. There are some women who will have a baby just so they will have someone to love them, they'll go to these homes and such, and we'll support them and care for them. And then, once they're back on their feet, what do? They go out there and do the exact same thing again. And we have to be making the case for marriage, and we have to realize what we're up against. Just this week, there was a story from a LifeSite News about an event thing in Seattle where two Christians holding signs at a homosexual event were assaulted. And, you know, we've had some people say, well, what would you say if someone came into your church gatherings who was homosexual and started raising a ruckus and someone assaulted them? I said, you know what, that's wrong. Unless they make the first physical assault, you don't treat them the same way. You don't fight people physically like that just because they disagree with you. You fight physically to save someone from harm. And you can say all you want to that some of these Christians were inciting these people to do this, supposedly. I don't care. We are supposed to practice self-control. That's like saying that it's the fault of a woman dressing attractively that the guy raped her. Yeah, the woman dressing attractively might have tempted the guy, but that guy is supposed to practice self-control. As a devoted husband, when I'm out in public with other women, if I'm seeing them, I am to practice self-control, keep my mind pure, and think about the woman that I married always. And you know what? For any guy out there, it is a battle to fight temptation. But you have to ask yourself, is it worth it? Is it what I'm going to be doing? Am I going to be practicing self-control? Or am I just going to follow all my lust and hedonistic impulses and pretty much just be an animal? And if you've been on Facebook, chances are you've seen this story about what happened in this assault case. Chances are, if you've been watching the mainstream media, though, you haven't heard a thing about it. Because this stuff is not getting covered. Now, if a situation had been reversed, we'd be hearing all about it. But we're not. You know what? Tolerance, as I've said several times, it is a one-way street. And Christian, if you are not speaking out because you are wanting to be tolerant, you are being played for a fool right now. Tolerance, true tolerance, means you disagree with a person who you're tolerant of, but you give them the right to express their views and to hold their views. And let's talk about diversity. They're not interested in diversity. If they were, they would be celebrating your view just as much. Diversity is not being celebrated. These are excuses used. In fact, I even find it suspicious that the whole anti-bullying movement arose around this time. Since bullies have always been around. I'm not justifying bullying. Not at all. You can't. Bullying is wrong. But it wouldn't surprise me if it was connected with the homosexual movement, with wanting to stop it. And yeah, people shouldn't bully homosexuals. But at the same time, I'm not saying that they need to be put in a special class of protection. Everyone needs to be treated like a human being in this regard. And we have to get past these sound bites. It's people out there saying, we oppose hate. You must not hate. Friends, you'd better hate some things. You have to. As a Christian, you are to hate evil. You are to hate injustice. You are to hate wrong. You are to hate the sin that exists in your own life. You have to hate things because you love other things. And the things you love are being threatened by the things you hate. Well, that's going to be my soapbox for this week. I urge you go to the Roof Institute and get some more information on these kinds of things, including their brochure on 77 secular reasons to not support redefining marriage, to support traditional marriage. If you're wondering what's going to be going on here next week, I've got C. Michael Patton of Credo House Ministries coming here. We're going to have a really good talk. This is a real down-to-earth guy. We'll be talking apologetics with him, what he does with his ministry. And again, I remind you, the passing of my wife's grandmother, please be praying for our family. Remember, if you can support us financially, prayerfully, please do whatever you can. Well, till then, my thanks to J. Warner Wallace again for being on the show. Really enjoyed it. Look forward to having him back here some other time. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast, and I will see you next week.